Hello and welcome to ETY Podcast, Voices on the World of Work. I'm your host, Bianca Luna Fabris, and in this episode, we will be hearing all about the new politics of growth models and stagnation with Lucio Baccaro, Mark Blythe, and Jonas Pontesson. Our three guests have very recently released a volume on this published by Oxford University Press, and they have also condensed their thoughts and ideas in a recent article for our journal Transfer, and you'll be able to find the link to both the article and the book in our show notes. I would actually like to ease into the podcast with a bit of an introductory question. And I have this question for you, Lucio, if you don't mind. So, new politics of growth and stagnation. What is it and why is it new?
Yeah, it's a book about capitalism. One of the highlights is that it has contributions from several scholars that are based in Europe, in the US, and who are specialists in either countries or regions or policy areas. Now, the point of departure is the diversity of capitalist trajectory. There is no one best way to organize a capitalist economy. There are several, and they are equally valid. And this is a staple of the comparative political economy approach. Compared to this tradition, the book does not stop at diversity of capitalism, but tries to go beyond and to link it systematically to cross-cutting trends that are taking place at the level of the international economy, liberalization, financialization, and the increase in inequality. Furthermore, it's a book about growth, and especially about the absence of growth, namely stagnation. And the driving question is, what happens to capitalist societies when growth, which is a powerful legitimator of capitalism, an inherently unequal society, becomes more difficult to produce? In terms of the novelty of the approach, I would say there are 5 points which are quite original, and they are developed in the book. First, it presents a new framework for analysis that shifts the attention away from the traditional focus on supply-side institutions, institutions that influence the competitiveness of key firms. Instead, it focuses on the level of composition of aggregate demand. So this demand focus is an innovative trait of the approach. Second, the book takes macroeconomics more seriously than it has been done so far, and also takes advantage of the fact that there is not just one macroeconomic theory, but several. So it takes advantage of pluralism in macroeconomics. In particular, it brings in post-Keynesian macroeconomics. And post-Keynesian macroeconomics argues that aggregate demand has both short-term and long-term effects on growth. Hence, for a book that focuses on demand and on growth, there are elective affinities with our approach to political economy. Third, the book sees different growth models, different varieties of growth, as national-level responses to a broad common trend that characterizes all advanced countries, and that's stagnation. And stagnation harks back to the crisis of a model of growth in which growth is pulled by wages, wage-led growth. The fourth point of innovation is that the book discusses how international political economy factors, and especially the presence or the absence of mechanisms for relaxing the current account constraint on growth, undergird the feasibility and durability of national growth models. This move implies going beyond methodological nationalism, the analysis of countries in isolation, and mobilizing both comparative political economy and international political economy in the analysis of capitalism. And fifth and finally, the book sets out a new approach to understanding the politics of growth models, an approach that tries to distinguish systematically between the politics of policy choice, policy formation, and the politics of democratic legitimation, as the two may have different logics.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Lucio. I think we're going to untangle these 5 points that you just mentioned a bit deeper throughout the podcast. Mark, I have a follow-up question for you, and following up on what Lucio just said on comparative political economy. So you do engage with the literature and particularly with the varieties of capitalism framework. What is your main critique of this approach?
Well, Lucio mentioned in passing, so let me unpack it a little bit more. The short version is it doesn't take demand seriously. To a certain extent, it's kind of a macro scaled up equilibrial Say's law claim that supply is what matters, not just in terms of the long run for the economy, but what matters, period. And it's very much drawn from a macroeconomics of a particular moment, that of the late 1990s. If you will, the kind of fusion of neo-Keynesian approaches and real business cycle approaches, the kind of dominant macro that led us into the financial crisis, where the supply side is almost everything and demand is nothing. And we think that that's fundamentally flawed because it reduces the international economy to a series of, if you will, passive price signals to which agents kind of monotonically respond, given their interests. The second thing is it's an equilibrium framework. And again, that's very much of a particular type of macro. And while that equilibrium framework is very powerful and persuasive, the idea of LMEs and CMEs, etc., in the canonical Holland-Soskes approach, there is another question as to whether these are real types, real things in the world, or whether they're kind of ideal types. And if they're ideal types, they don't really exist. And that then makes us question, well, are these equilibrium relationships which are posited to be driving things really real things in the world, or are they kind of analogical models of how things kind of work? And what we wanted to do was to really get away from that, to put demand right at the front rather than supply, and to think about how we can think of capitalism post-2008 in particular is much more dynamic, much more disequilibrial, and how a variety of different institutional and political combinations can lead to a variety of very different growth models. So rather than hewing to one or two types or diverging for one or two types, you can have a much, much wider variety of real actual models in the world. And that's what we were trying to get at.
So it's quite clear to me that you advance basically a new and alternative political economy approach, the growth model approach. So Jonas, perhaps you would like to engage with this question. And my question really is, how and in which ways is this actually different?
Yeah, I think that Lucio and Mark has touched on almost all the main things that we think are kind of distinctive about our approach, certainly on the demand side and drivers, demand drivers of growth. Let me say two things. First of all, and this relates to varieties of capitalism, but it relates to a lot of at least comparative political economy, that they're all involving typologies and they have all ended up being fairly simple and I would argue very reified typologies. So in the varieties of capitalism tradition, we sort of have two types, maybe three types. And we end up, critics of this tradition end up arguing, we all end up arguing about whether these, as Mark puts it, whether these types are ideal or real. And the same goes for the sort of varieties of welfare state literature of Esping Anderson and so on, that we sort of, so much of the debate has ended up being about the types and whether Sweden is like Germany or whether, and I think we're trying to get away from, so we do have some types of growth models, but I think we want to emphasize variety in more than just two types and hybrids and a kind of, as Mark said, a more dynamic perspective in which getting the label on a particular country right, at least for me, is something we should avoid. The labeling exercise is not the important thing that's going on here, but rather the focus on a certain way of thinking about growth models and how they evolve and how they might change. And clearly, components of aggregate demand are important there. Also, and I think Lucio already mentioned this, I think sectors become very important in our framework. So we're not only interested, sometimes we talk about export-led growth, but I think if you read the individual chapters, it becomes clear that exports are different in character. Some countries are exporters of raw materials. We have a chapter on Latin America on sort of resource-led export growth. Other countries are exporting supply or are part of a supply chain, Eastern Europe, for instance. Some countries export mostly high-end services. Others, like Germany, are more traditional manufacturing exporters. So in that sense, even if we sometimes end up sort of distinguishing between consumption-led or domestic consumption-led growth and export-led growth, we also want to distinguish between different types of export-led growth, I think. So I think that's really sort of sectors and kind of disaggregating. So we shouldn't, or I don't want us to end up sort of simply sticking with the distinction consumption-led versus export-led. And with respect to consumption-led, we have in some cases consumption being financed by wages, and in other cases consumption being financed by credit. And we certainly have some countries in which upper middle class consumption is emphasized. And that, I think, is also an important part of what we are doing that's new, is distributive issues. Inequality have featured in comparative political economy before. But I think that the discussion of profit-led or profit shares versus wage shares, for instance, and this is something we bring in from post-Keynesian economics and also Marxist economics, and that has been, you know, the lack of attention to profits in the comparative political economy literature, and in particular, the varieties of capitalism literature, is really striking. I mean, how can we talk about capitalism without talking about profits versus wage share? And I think actually, this is a bit of a critique of the book as I, for self-criticism, that I think that I wish we had a chapter that dealt more systematically with distributive issues, both functional distribution between labor and capital, but also distribution among different types of wage earners. And for various reasons, which we could get into, we never actually managed to line that chapter up. And I think that's for the next edition, that's one of the chapters I would like to add.
So growth models exist at a national level, and you've all made this quite clear. But what about the supranational level? And particularly, I'm thinking about the EU, and perhaps, Mark, you would like to jump into this one.
Yeah, so basically what happened, the background to the book was these guys published a piece in Politics and Society in 2016, which was very much the comparative political economy version. And it invoked, you know, things that I like, demand, Kolletsky, post-Keynesian economics, like, ooh, this is good. And around the same time, I did another one with Matthias Matthias that basically did a very similar analysis, but at a global level. And that's basically part of the impetus for the project, was to bring these two things together. So let's give a concrete example for the EU, right? Everyone will intuitively get this, right? Cornel Bahn, who's somebody that we have writing a chapter on financialization, wrote a wonderful book a few years ago where he compared Romania's accession to the EU with Spain's accession to the EU. And the point he made was a very subtle one, but a very important one, that the Europe that each of those countries joined was quite different, right? When Spain was joining, it was a much more social democratic Europe. And it was very much neoliberalism on crack when it was Romania's turn to basically come under the cosh. That type of dynamic is something that was very hard to capture in unit level analysis. Right, that's why the supernatural matters, right? You can also make the point, you know, if you're Latvia or Ireland, obviously, like, you know, global capital flows determine your growth model, right? You basically are a corporate sort of, you know, entrepot, or you're a money launderer, you know. But it's also true for big countries, as we found out with the end of Russian gas and the decoupling of China from the global economy. This is not great if you're a large export-led economy like the United, like Germany, for example. So how do we systematically think about this? I'll give you an example from the EU. Prior to the crisis, you had a whole variety of different growth models in the EU. Some were more quote-unquote successful than others in delivering growth, but there was real variety. Then when the crisis hit, and what is actually a private sector banking crisis gets re-diagnosed as a crisis of sovereign debt, you invent the pigs, the gypsies, etc., the troika come in, and then a whole new set of institutions from the European semester to the six-pack, etc., come in, and you basically end up constricting not just what you can do with your budget, but the type of economy that you can have going forward. As the Germans put it at the time, we all need to be a bit more German. Well, of course, the problem is there's a giant fallacy of composition at the heart of this. For someone to be exporting, someone else has to be importing. And if you are a common market space, as the European Union is, what happened to the periphery countries, the consumption countries was their imports collapsed, and that made it look like their exports were surging. So on the one hand, you could say, yeah, but now we're all running a surplus against the rest of the world. Yeah, but look at what's happening internally. You've basically disallowed the space for these consumption-led growth models to do their thing, and that constriction is basically allowing the export-led growth models to be more successful. So it's those types of international, inter-regional dynamics that are really important for understanding how things play out in these unit-level cases.
Jonas, I can see that you would like to add something on this. Go ahead.
I wanted to say something. I think an interesting idea that gets represented in the book, not only in the chapter on the EU, but also in the chapter on China. So the way Mark talked about it, or the way you asked the question, was about sort of the national and the supranational. And we imagine that there is a growth model at the level of the nation, and then there is interdependence among growth models. But I think also you could make the case, as the chapter on China does, that China is really a conglomeration of growth models. And I think one could very easily make a similar case about the US, and in some ways, perhaps the EU too. So there is the national and the supranational, but there are also sort of nations, or in the case of the EU, larger entity that sort of integrate or try to integrate multiple growth models that may or may not be complementary to each other.
So as we are the European Trade Union Institute, it's quite natural that we do ask a question on labour and wages. And of course, my question then goes to Lucho. So what role for labour and wages in growth models?
Yeah, if the international systemic level is Mark's gig, this one is in some respect my gig, the role of labour, industrial relations. And, you know, if we were to add another chapter to the second edition, that chapter would also be one that explicitly deals with trade unions, wages, labor market institutions. We don't have a dedicated chapter on these themes in diminishing returns, but if you read through the introduction, it's clear that they play a very important role in growth models, as they have an impact simultaneously on both the demand side and the supply side of the economy. In particular, collective bargaining determines wages and therefore affects household spending, affects consumption, but also indirectly, it also affects investments that may be stimulated by the perspective of an expanding demand. National collective bargaining, one of the arguments we make about it, was a crucial institution of the wage-led growth model phase, the phase that became impractical after with the onset of globalization. And we argue that the erosion of collective bargaining, national level collective bargaining, was crucial for the emergence of a stagnation trend across advanced economies, and contributes to explaining both the emergence and the instability of the post-Fordist growth models. I mean, in attributing this crucial role to national collective bargaining in the Fordist phase, the wage-led growth model phase, we hark back to this French literature called the École de la Régulation. Now, wages do not just affect, and are not just alone in affecting aggregate demand, also the distribution of income has very important effects for demand. Because those people, those households who primarily rely on labor income, tend to have a greater propensity to consume than households that rely primarily on profit income. And thus, if you reduce labor income, you're going to have a tendential decline in consumption. Same thing if consumption will also suffer is if real wages increase more slowly than productivity, which implies a fall in the wage share. Now, this fall in the wage share may promote exports, but if the stimulus is insufficient, and that will happen if the export sector is not sufficiently large, the end result will be stagnation. As I was mentioning before, investments too may be affected by a decline of real wages and of the wage share. if the economy is structurally wage-led and if investments are sensitive to the prospect of a rising demand and not very sensitive to profitability, what will happen is that investment will suffer. And if that happens, then the potential of the economy will shrink. Furthermore, there are effects from industrial relations, dynamics and institutions to labor productivity. One type of effect is the so-called Kalldorfer-Dorn effect, which links aggregate demand to productivity. As demand expands, productivity increases because economies of scale become feasible. There are other effects. Wage pressure exercised by trade unions and labor rigidities tend to encourage technological change. By making labor more expensive, by increasing the price of labor relative to the price of capital, they encourage capital deepening, namely the increase in the amount of capital per unit of work, and this tends to increase productivity. This is known as Marx-Hicks effect. Furthermore, if labor is relatively expensive, management will be encouraged to use it effectively, hence to introduce organizational changes that optimize the use of labor. Now, this is not automatic, of course. The implementation of organizational changes is contingent on the type of unions and workplace relationships, and we know it's tends to be more difficult to introduce organizational and technical change when trade unions are dominated by craft unions, which are known to be less amenable to workplace change due to the tendency to fight the loss of skills and employment as a result of technological change. Whereas more encompassing unions that organize across skills are more likely to internalize the positive systemic consequences of technical change. Now, I have to introduce a caveat here. These arguments that I've just developed are known to be applicable to the manufacturing sector. We know much less whether these arguments about economies of scale and the innovation enhancing effect of labor rigidities are really applicable to the service sector. In any case, the bottom line here is that by enhancing productivity and favoring innovations, labor institutions, labor rigidities act as beneficial constraints. This is exactly the opposite from what we learn from mainstream analysis, according to which one needs to liberalize the labor market in order to stimulate efficiency and productivity. But it is also important for our argument because it follows from this way of analyzing things that the erosion of industrial relations institutions has actually contributed to the stagnation of labor productivity and the stagnation to core of advanced economies.
I now have a concluding question for Jonas on the role of politics. So does politics matter, and does it matter in the same way as we know it from the existing comparative political economy literature, or does it function in a different way in the growth models approach?
We think politics matters hugely. And the question is, what do we mean by politics? In the literature that we are coming out of and trying to go beyond to some extent, there's been a long-standing debate. One side in this debate says, well, it's interest group politics or producer group politics that matters. And the other side says it's electoral politics. So there is sort of producer groups making policies, and then there is electoral politics. And we think that this kind of attempt to have a horse race between these two kinds of politics is misguided. Both matter. We also think they should not be collapsed, that they really are two separate domains of politics and they play different roles. So when it comes to the policies, growth models have to be maintained, reproduced through policies. And the main policies that are in play are fiscal and monetary, macroeconomic types of policies. These policies are rarely, if ever, contested in the electoral arena. They are policies that are made in relatively closed policy circles. Experts play a role. Party leaders play a role. High-level civil servants play a role. And certainly interest groups play a role. And we think of that kind of politics as being the politics of dominant growth coalitions. And they are relatively closed in the sense that people cannot intervene in them. They have policy paradigms that they have developed over periods of time. And the key sectors in the economy have a very privileged role to play in those growth coalitions or in the politics of policy choice, if you wish. And they play a key role in part because if parties want to be reelected, they want economic growth and they need to cater to those particular interests that are critical for generating productivity growth, but also generating or responding to the demands that are being featured in a particular growth model. Electoral politics is not about that, we think. Electoral politics is not about choosing macroeconomic policies. It's much more about legitimating the growth model and possibly buying off groups of citizens who are powerful, but are not really in the growth coalition, or their interests are not really being served by the growth model. So electoral politics is about side payments, if you wish, and it's about creating popular consent, often passive consent in the sense that what the managers of the growth model want is for citizens to not rock the boat, and they want to convince citizens that either they stand to gain from the growth model or that there is no other alternative or there's no other viable growth model but the one that we have now. So in that sense, I think the Gramscian concept of passive consent, at least for me, is a very important part of the way we think about electoral politics. Electoral politics creates potentially constraints on what the managers of the growth model can do, but it doesn't tell them what to do. And of course, if you fail to generate economic growth, you're going to fail to generate legitimacy. And in this scenario, this opens the door to a kind of noisy politics. And in some sense, at least in some cases, the growth model itself is up for grabs, as it were. And clearly, Brexit and the current crisis in the British politics is an example of this kind of noisy politics that when things go very wrong, and presumably we would argue something similar about Trump, and I think in many other countries in a much more quiet way, the old growth coalition has become much smaller, or it has contracted in certain ways. And clearly we see large constituencies of the masses or of the electorate that are no longer committed to the policy paradigms that have been pursued over the last 20, 25 years.
Thank you so much to those that have been listening this far. You'll be able to find all of the articles and books mentioned throughout the podcast in the show notes. Until the next one.